This week on A to Z Running, we kick off a new series on change, examining Brad Stolberg's newest book, Master of Change, and how we might apply those principles to this new year with its new goals.
We also answer a listener question about the mental side of running.
In the world of running, 2023 ended with a nice bang for Beatrice Chebet and a new world record.
And we take some time to remember what we believe to be the top 10 moments from the world of running in 2023.
All this and a happy new year this week on A to Z Running.
Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I'm Zach, and you can find out everything you need to know about the work we do and what it's like at atozrunning.com, and follow us on the places we are most frequenting, Instagram, Spotify, and YouTube.
Yeah, and if you see us at events, feel free to introduce yourself, because I was able to meet a handful of people I hadn't met before that listened to the podcast at Resolution Run. So that was really cool. Give a couple shout outs for a couple that I remember, Ethan and Sarah.
Nice. And that is in large part one of the main reasons why we do events outside of, you know, like primary goal race types of things, is because we like to meet you all and run with you all and chat with you all and you know, the event experience type of thing. You're with runners doing the running thing together. Mm-hmm. It's loads of fun.
I also met a young man from Alaska who was at the Resolution Run, and he listens to the podcast. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, but good luck to you, a young guy. We're reaching the younger demographic now, so yahoo.
That's fun. It was like running in summer for you if you're from Alaska and you got to run in 35 degrees.
Nice.
That's the other thing. We don't run races in the dead of winter in Michigan because we like racing in the dead of winter in Michigan. It's just proof positive even more that runners really like to be in the running experience together, because why else would you run a race in winter?
It was really well done. It was a fun race. We had a good time at Resolution Run in East Grand Rapids, Michigan.
What a way to end the year. And what a way to start the next one by listening to us. That's right. You are starting your new year with A to Z Running right now. In whenever you're listening to this, hopefully it's near the start of the new year, or you're proving me wrong. But we are excited to be able to help usher in that experience for you in some of the ways that we're going to do that. And we're going to get started with that here shortly. Before we do, let's jump in with your questions. Speaking of younger generation of runners, this question comes from listener Addison, who's also a high school runner. So that's always fun. That is a good time to be a runner. Well, all times are a good time to be a runner, but fond memories from the younger days. Well, thank you for the question, Addison. What we want to do here is try to share some thoughts and see if we can support you in your debate. So Addison's question comes from a conversation he was having with his brother and cousin. He says, "My brother and cousin were wondering if running races is a mind game. I said that it is most definitely a mind game, but they said that it isn't." Well, first of all, are they both runners as well? And I actually know the answer to that, but our listeners don't. And so, secondly, and I only ask that because your experience has a lot to do with how you answer this question for every single person, right? Because we could probably never say that an answer here is blanket true for everyone all the time. But we can speak to what things tend to be the case. So now you get to find out, Addison and the rest of the listeners, whether Andy and Zach agree on this topic. So here's my painting a picture with a single brush kind of thing. I think that the mental side of running is more of a factor for the undisciplined or the mentally undisciplined runner. And I'll explain what I mean in more detail in a moment. But What that then creates is there's kind of a spectrum of influence. So for, if you look at like the upper world-class athletes, what gives them an edge over each other has very little to do with the mental side of things. It has far more to do with the precisions of how they are prepared and how that's manifesting that day. How else do you get a whole bunch of runners who on various different days all ran like world record times over the course of one summer? And then when they race against each other, only one of them wins, right? And so you could say they're all the fastest in history in some sense. But what gave the runner that edge that day? You can't possibly say, well, they won the mental game necessarily, because that can be the case. But it's just as likely that something about what's going on behind the scenes contributed. Now, so we say that, and you can argue the exact opposite.
Yeah, which I will for a second, because I think Zach is thinking of mental game as you between other people, where I would say that within yourself, if you're prepared, it will rattle you less. But it is a game that you prepare for in practice. You prepare for on your runs. You prepare for by years and years of experience. I think it is very much a mental game, but as you continue in the sport, you get better and better and better at that game, and things will rattle you less mentally as you compete.
That's exactly my point. It's less of a factor the more experienced you are, and less of a factor depending on the nature of how you approach that. So that's where I say, like, at that level, at that world-class level, they're all doing about the same thing. They're all, you know, these runners toe the line, and they all believe that they are the very best, right? And they all have similar kinds of mental discipline, and in some senses, they may even actually have the same people helping them with those things too. A lot of those runners actually run for the same teams. So as it were, my point is not that it's not a factor. My point is that it's less of a factor and more of a factor depending on the individual and the situation. So let me note here that so where you see the most substantial influence of this kind of like mental mismatch is in that mismatch theory concept, where expectation and reality differ, and how I have or have not prepared for that moment, those types of things, then you see a big discrepancy. And so that's where I would say, you know, the situation, I'll give you both sides of it. Okay, you're running a race, Addison, and you're saying to yourself, this hurts. There are two ways you can respond to that, potentially, certainly more, but for the sake of argument. One could be, this hurts, and I don't think I can do this. The other could be, this hurts, it might be my body telling me it's too much at the moment. So in both situations, you may slow down a touch, right? But one of them is defeatist. One of them is me telling myself, I am failing. And the other one is more of a not yet mentality. I'm a little bit over my head at the moment. I'm going to back off a touch, but I'm coming back.
Or another scenario is, it hurts, but I only have X amount left and I can hurt that way until the finish line.
Yes, there's a lot more. I guess my point was, I was saying that those both result in the same immediate situation. You slow down in both scenarios, but the end result is likely very different. So what it becomes then is, my argument is that the mental side of racing is something that contributes more or less depending on some of those considerations, and it should contribute less and less as you spend time in the sport. And when it doesn't contribute, when it's continuing to be a major obstacle, then that raises red flags about there's something here that should be worked on. And that's where you could look at, you know, I would argue that it's largely either experience or my approach. And so if experience isn't teaching me and I'm not improving, then I would look at my approaches. What am I doing that I could potentially adjust?
Mm-hmm. I still do think that even at the top of the game, there are definitely mental barriers to success, even at the top levels. And some would say that Jakob Ingebrigtsen might be struggling with some of that when it comes to championship races, maybe because he hasn't been winning them, but he's had the fastest times in the world.
Yeah, but is that really true? Is that really possible? Like, this guy, there can be no runner more confident in himself.
But I think that could be the problem. It could be that he does not, you know how Alicia Munson says that she imagines every scenario and then how she'll overcome them. Well, maybe this is totally, this is just totally guesswork. Maybe he never imagines that someone else will pull up in front of him. And so it's when it happens, he just falls apart.
Who knows? But then he comes back and wins a race later on, like,
I don't
chip
know
on his shoulder. I don't know. I don't know. But so
I think there are, Addison, I think there are mental games that happen even for professionals that are seasoned. I think that the rattling happens less as they learn to adjust to it. But I do think there are many athletes from every level who do struggle with mental game. And I do too. Like, I'll be the first to admit that sometimes I get down, and I have tools in my toolbox now that I can use. But sometimes a thought comes into my head that's not productive when I'm running, and I learn how to wrestle with that and then get the best out of myself.
Yeah, so I guess what it comes down to is the argument that I'm trying to make is probably proving the opposite point more than the point I was going to try to prove. It is true that the running aspect has a major mental component. What's interesting about it is that you can have so many situations where a runner is physiologically capable of a thing and does not realize that potential. And how can that be, right? How can it be that it's a perfect day? It's not a weather or conditions thing. The fueling was all incorrect. If it's like a longer race or eating fuel before the race, you know, I don't have GI problems, is I guess what I'm trying to say. Everything's perfect. My training and preparation was perfect. And yet I don't achieve my potential in that moment. What inhibited that? And the argument can be made that it was some of this other factor. And I don't know exactly what that other factor is, because there's so many other things that contribute to it. But if a runner were to say that it doesn't really matter, the mental side of it doesn't really matter, of course, that's not true. That is not true. So I guess in this debate, Addison, you can be the arbiter, but it's quite clear that Andy is probably more winning the argument.
It's a very important piece of the puzzle, but it is one that you can continue to improve and grow in.
And I should say it like this, it's an obstacle that can be removed, not probably perfectly and entirely, because, you know, we are human and we change, and so we have to always be kind of refining ourselves in some sense, which happens to have a lot to do with our coming topic in a moment. But as it were, there are things about how we approach the sport and how we view ourselves and our efforts that can take this major question mark much, much down, further down a peg. That was a terrible way to say that. But it reduces the obstacle, if not removes it. So there you have it. Now it's a question of how to do that. And I think we're going to address a fair bit of that here in our coming topic. So let's get on to something else helpful.
Our new series for a new year is on change. Can't avoid it. So here we are. We're going to talk about it, and we're going to be better at handling it. And why do we have this topic? We're trying to time it for you with the start of the new year and resolutions and all that entails.
Yeah. I really don't love talking about New Year's resolutions. I'm one of those people that's like, because you told me now's the time to change, I'm not going to do it.
But the funny thing is that last week I was like, just start as soon as you think that something would benefit you and then stay consistent to that. And you're like, actually, the start of a fresh year is a good time to do it.
So Andy's right in principle. I was just simply stating that sociological and psychological research seems to indicate there are times that are better to start things than others, and this is one of them. So yes, we're going to talk about change, and the premise need not be overstated. So just to give another example that is kind of interesting is Forbes conducted yet another survey. People do this every year. How many people are setting resolutions, and what are they about? And this 2024 New Year's resolution survey, apparently lots of people have resolutions. Not surprising. However, it seems to be fewer than one would expect, like closer to the 40% range, as opposed to what Forbes survey says, like 64, 65%. but that was a, you know, their the population they surveyed. Other surveys that are seem to be broader show fewer, but you know, it's a lot, right? Most of us say to ourselves, here's something I'm going to do differently this year. Okay, now that being the case, what did they find? Well, about half of those people said top goal was in the realm of fitness, which we find both relatable in the work that we do and interesting. In the last few years, it was each of the last few years, it was mental health, which is not surprising with the whole COVID scenario. That was obviously front of mind for a number of reasons. The fact that that's no longer, in fact, fitness was 20%, 30% higher of a goal, which is fascinating. And if you take into account other related things like healthy diet, losing weight, things like that, basically like trying to take good care of our bodies is way, way up there for people. But what we find interesting is then when people start to reflect on, okay, so how am I going to achieve that? A very small percentage said anything about holding themselves accountable. It's like 20%. And where Forbes even noted in the past, that number was more like 80%. That's a huge swing.
So they don't plan on sticking to it? Is that what it means?
This is a tricky one because there's no narrative explanation. What do you mean when you say you're not going to hold yourself accountable? But at the same time, that question is coupled with what are some things you're going to use to help you achieve the goal? And many would put things like some kind of app that tracks your activity or fitness, or that you set goals and monitor them with some kind of app, things like that, right? Which I think is part of this holding yourself accountable. So I think that that question may be somewhat misconstrued. But even if not, it's clear that a lower percent of people intend to have a system for achieving their goal as opposed to more just kind of an intuitive. And we all know how this goes when you just say, I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to just make it part of my new habit. And come February, we'll see if that's true anymore. But that's what we find, right? Now, it's also the case, as we all know, that many of us, most in fact, are not going to be doing that new thing anymore after a month or two. And if we get to the end of the year, it's closer to 90% of people are no longer doing the thing they set out to do at the start of the year.
But I wonder how many people that like start a habit when they think they're going to do it. How many of those people? Because that's not studied. So perhaps you just start doing the thing and making a commitment and hold yourself accountable any time of year.
So this is part of, but this is important. So the one side of it is the reason why we start things at the new year is because it is true that people are more likely to be motivated to start something new at a natural new beginning. First day of the week, first day of the year, first day of the month, all of that. This year is the magical three. It doesn't happen often, but we have January 1st on a Monday, the start of the year. That's all three of them at once. So this is like, you should be, I said this already once on the podcast recently, you should by default be super successful with anything you just started this year because of the magic. But it's not true. And so that's where we get into now. Here's the tricky part, because the mindset there, be very careful with how we think about why we are choosing these types of things. The mindset of I will start this then is already slightly self-defeating, or you're contending with yourself, because what you're already saying is it's not something that I should start right now. It's something that I will start at some point in time.
Or you're sad because you're listening to this and you're like, oh man, I didn't actually start on Monday at the beginning of the year.
I didn't take advantage of the magical three.
I don't know if I'm that committed. Like, I didn't start it right away. I'm not going to have this full year thing, a streak.
What's that?
That's also a danger. So if you haven't started yet, it's okay. Start today.
Well, because what it becomes then is we want to be the kind of people, and I'm speaking for you, but I think I speak accurately enough for every single person on the planet. We want to be the kind of people who, when we recognize the need for something different, that we can move toward that thing, right? That's the kind of person that we want to be. I want to be able to see a need and move toward it. in myself and in my world and things like that, right? So take action when action is needed, you could say. Now, that of course then undermines the principle. And this is why it's so important, because this idea of I'll start on that day because that's a fresh start day, that undermines this concept in myself that I'm no longer taking action when action is needed. I'm delaying action. And that we have to be careful about that. So anyway, the point is, I agree more with Andy than the research on principle. But as we know, it just is more likely that we'll feel motivated to do something new at a fresh beginning.
But as we know, change is hard.
And that's it.
It is so hard.
So here's what we want to do. We're setting up for you a series. And what we're going to try to do with this series is we're going to examine this idea of how we can be more effective at change. We're going to use Brad Stolberg's latest book, Master of Change. We have acquired the material and we've been able to spend some time chewing on this. And as we do, we're going to bring you his principles and how they apply. Now, we'll be the first to acknowledge we do not agree with every line of Brad Stolberg's conclusions and his ideas himself. And I think that's great, because it's one of the things I like about when I read a text and I think, okay, there's a lot of great stuff here, but it doesn't mean I have to agree with all of it. And I think that's important. As you know, as scholarly people, we want to read with a, what's the word? We want to examine critically the things we are thinking and the things we are encountering, as it were. There's some good stuff here. And we're going to take now a few weeks to basically try to address how can we most effectively change well and face change in life in general. And we think it's going to be helpful to you as you set your new goals for the year, as you try to pursue them in the midst of this. The main thing here is that by the very nature of saying this is a new thing, that means something has to change. And that is where we want to spend a few minutes right now. Why is that so hard? And what are some of the things we tend to do in response to change that undermine our efforts?
And recognizing it is super important as a step to be able to make change and create change. It's like when you think of something that's difficult ahead of you, maybe it's a running course. And if you know what twists and turns and hills and hay bales you might be jumping over, it's going to help you prepare well, and it's going to help you have the proper expectations, and you can then prepare yourself mentally, emotionally for when those obstacles do come. And maybe the days you need to give yourself grace and still say, this is a commitment I have, but I'm sick and I'm not going to be able to make my commitment here today. So it's all these things, and we're going to dive into some of these obstacles or challenges that come with change.
So let's talk a little bit about some of that here, just to kind of set the tone properly. We always want to go back to it. I think it's just a really helpful point of reference because it's common vernacular. Where does this concept of like change is hard tend to come from? And we shared, I don't know exactly, this was a couple of years ago now.
Yeah.
We shared in an episode, we talked about as runners, what are some of the common changes we face and how to navigate that. One of the things we did in that episode is just kind of addressed this principle here with this quote. And so I want to share it again. It's Edgar Rice Burroughs. I believe he's the author of Tarzan.
Interesting.
So, yeah, I know. It's you know, insight and wisdom come from many places. Back in 1914 is when he wrote these words. So it tells you, you know, this is a timeless principle, as many are. We are, all of us, Burroughs writes, creatures of habit. So there's the phrase, we are creatures of habit. And when the seeming necessity for schooling ourselves in new ways ceases to exist, we fall naturally and easily into the manner and customs which long usage has implanted ineradicably within us.
Hmm.
We do the thing that we are inclined to do, wherever that inclination comes from. And that's so that's why change is hard. And we have yet to find a source, as we've read anything on this topic, that says anything other than that in some sense or another. Change is hard because the status quo has this kind of like gravitational momentum.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rut and it's really hard to get out of it, and it's always going in one direction.
I grew up with a circle pool. and we would always do these pool circles. We go round and round and round. We did like a whirlpool. And when you first turn around for like four laps, it's really hard. It's hard to even feel like you're moving. You are moving.
Well, the littler people aren't moving. They're getting thrown back with the current.
This is an that doesn't help my illustration. Oh. But it's hard. It's hard and you feel like you're barely making progress in the pool. But then eventually as you go and the opposite direction, you start to build momentum that way. That's what change is like. That momentum.
Swimming upstream.
But then it eventually does, as you continue to do it more and more and more, it gets ingrained into your framework.
Yeah. And as you might guess, the more established, the more firmly established, as Burroughs writes, the longer the usage of those manner and customs, the harder it is to get out of that.
The stronger the current.
That is right.
Yeah.
And so these are not new things for you, but as we look at the things we're trying to accomplish, invariably progress in any sense and form and fashion is a kind of change. And that's why it becomes so difficult then to improve ourselves. There's something about myself I want to improve. It is hard. I'll share one personal example.
Please.
One recent personal example. So I like sugar.
Sure.
It's true. I am inclined to do things like Andy made a pan of brownies. Everyone ate one and then the boys went to bed and then Daddy ate the rest. All of them. The whole pan of brownies. And didn't even notice I was doing it. I'm inclined to do things like bring a bag of licorice with me while I'm driving to work. And by the end of the day, when I get home, I've discovered I've eaten the entire bag of licorice and don't know exactly when I did that. I like sugar. So I decided, and this was not coupled with the New Year's, this was about 3 weeks ago, and spontaneously, I'm looking at my sugar intake and I'm thinking there's nothing healthy about that. And I am the kind of person who frequently argues against consuming any kind of substance that has no net positive value for my body. I just simply find it to be illogical. And there lurking in the background for so many years was this tendency of mine that I just hadn't really contemplated. Now I'm contemplating it. And in the further context of the fact that my boys will ask for a treat after a meal and will say, okay, here's about how much you can have. Well, why don't we just say you can have as much as you want? Well, because it's not good for them, right? And yet, here's my ongoing habit. So I said to myself, no, that's not okay. So instead, my principle, my guiding rule is I'm just not going to eat any more of a dessert or treat or sugar than I would otherwise tell my boys they could eat. You know, they're tasty, it's yummy, and in small quantities, it's not bad for your body. In fact, there are some elements of that that can be good for your body. You know, some ready available sugars for the activity you're about to do, that kind of thing. But anyway, at least limiting it to the point of how much I would let my sons eat. And so there I find myself needing to make a change. And here's the thing I'm trying to say right now. Every single time I walk past a place where something sugary is sitting, there's this like gravity that just pulls my hand right toward it. And it is without my own will. It just happens. And so I have to be more conscientious and deliberate. It takes cognitive energy to not unwrap a Reese's peanut butter cup and eat it because it's sitting there. I don't know exactly when that conscious energy is going to get easier. It has not yet, but I can tell you that it's definitely better than it was before, and I'm moving in the right direction. So anyway, okay, so that's the thing, right? Now let's give you a taste of Brad Stolberg for a moment. Thank you, Andy. Stolberg argues that we respond poorly to change, and that's one of the main reasons why it's hard, because we just make bad choices as a result of things that are changing around us. And he gave four primary common ways. Want to share these, give you some quick connections for us in our running world. The first one is attempting to avoid or refusing to acknowledge the change. There's change happening. I don't even want to, I'm going to deny it.
Yeah. Because this is not, we're not just talking about making a New Year's resolution or something. We're talking about all change, including that of which is thrust upon us.
Well, and, you know, the need for whatever that New Year's resolution is can be an example of some changes in some sense too. But yes, so things around me are changing. I don't like it. I'm going to ignore it. Or I'm going to, he used an example, doubling down on the thing that I've done in the past, even though it's not effective. So this can be a situation with our goals where we say, okay, I want to change this thing about myself. So I'm going to do more of this other thing before, but that didn't actually work. But that's, I don't want to change what I was doing because that's familiar, right? So that can be difficult and ineffective. And then further, a step further is number two on his list, actively resisting change, where we say, okay, this thing is changing and I am going to fight against it. And one of the examples he gives is this massive industry of anti-aging. He says, aging is of course inevitable. And yet, if you are one of those companies that started some anti-aging products and found them to be at least somewhat mysteriously effective, you're making a lot of money. But that is a kind of resistance to change. Hmm. And I'm not suggesting that necessarily inherently is bad, but that is a common way we respond to change.
I think in the running dimension, actively resisting change is knowing you have an injury and continuing to run and deny that anything is wrong. And so you kind of just limp along for months knowing that something isn't right.
Like you should be doing something differently. You know that you should. Resting, seeking medical intervention, something like that. And you're refusing to do it. That's not good. That's not a good thing. He actually gives another example in the book about injury related where, you know, it's like, you know, you've had the scans, you know, that you've got a breakdown happening in something somewhere. And yet you're refusing to go see the specialists and look at treatment options. So yes, that's
we're
common.
Really good at that yeah. as runners, I think.
Yeah, well, so this is huge. Those top two for runners are probably the most common ones of these four. And in large part, it's this idea that if I have to change my routine, then I'm going to lose something. And so we resist or at least deny it as much as we can until we get to the point where we are incapacitated by it. And that's just bad. It harms us so much, Andy and I are as guilty as anyone, having done that plenty of times over the years, and always the temptation to do so is there. It's like this just nagging thought in the back of the mind. Maybe this is not okay, the thing that I'm feeling, but I really don't want to admit it. Mm-hmm. Number three is sacrifice agency amidst chaos.
What does that mean?
To be fascinated. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. He's basically talking about the idea that that I no longer feel, so change is something that happens to me, not change is something that I can operate some kind of deliberate control within. And so that's where he starts talking about, he refers to like our attention, where things just drag our attention away all over the place. And it's like, you know, this is happening in the world and I'm glued to the news feeds or the social medias and stuff, and I'm not paying any attention to, I'm not deliberately attending to things. He also gives an example of just that we react without any kind of plan to a thing that's happening. And so it's like, this is happening, so I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to try this, and then I'm going to do this. And it's just kind of like the whim, as opposed to, here's what's happening, and I should make a plan. How am I going to address this thing in my life? And that I think we do a lot as well as runners. It's like, you know, I need to do something differently. And so I'm going to go to Instagram and find this cool thing that an exercise that someone's doing, or this workout that someone suggested. Or, you know, my friend said, hey, you join me on my mile repeats today. I was like, I'm going to do that. That sounds good. I need to get in a good hard effort. And next week I might try something different. And it's just kind of scattershot without that kind of deliberate plan strategy for how to address the thing. It's very hard to see it happen successfully. The last one, number four, try to get back to where we were. Number four.
Which is where I come in with an example.
Yep.
I have had quite a few serious injuries in the last couple of years, and it's very difficult for me to be able to see where I am and not where I want to be, or even if I do accept where I am, not to just be a little disappointed about it. Mm-hmm. For instance, I just ran the resolution run. It's a 4-mile run, and I have been doing unstructured training, just trying to build to where I can get into a regular training program. And I had no expectations going into the race, and I exceeded those expectations. And I still, when I looked at my results afterward, what the effort yielded, I was like, I have run a marathon at that pace. And I hated that I thought that, because I exceeded the expectation and where I thought I should, like where I thought my current place in fitness would yield me, but still was disappointed. So I think a lot of us do try to get back too quickly to where we were. And even if we do practice some patience, it is a lingering mind game, I guess. Hey, there are mind games, Addison, in training too. So,
but also, in principle, every new moment as a runner, we are not the same runner we were before. And we shouldn't expect the exact same things as what we've observed before. And so the example often even goes back to things like, why should it matter that your easy mileage this season is or is not similar to what it was last season? Why should that matter in terms of pace? Why should it matter that you ran a 5K at week four of your training last year, and this year when you ran that 5K at week four, it was a different time? Better or worse? Why does that matter so much to us? Like, isn't it possible that the 5K could be a lot slower this year and the end race be a lot faster? Isn't it possible that my easy mileage could be a lot slower this season and then faster another season and then slower again? Or maybe just overall it's slower than it's been ever before, and yet I'm racing faster than I ever have. Like, aren't those things all possible? So why should it matter to us whether or not we're doing things exactly like what we've done in the past? It's a difficult scenario. Mm-hmm. Now, let's zoom out a second. So those are the four most common, as Stolberg suggests, and that's part of the reason why change is hard, because we respond to it in ways that are counterproductive. The main point here that Stolberg is offering then brings him to this phrase, or it's a word. They talk a lot about homeostasis, right, as kind of like the that's the thing we want. We crave homeostasis. And he's like, instead, and this isn't Brad Stolberg's own concept, he's referencing some material here, but someone came up with this term, allostasis, which the word allo is Greek, and it basically means variable. So variable standing is what allostasis means. And as a status quo, allostasis is essentially the idea that I'm in a state of change and adaptability. Which, okay, there's a point to be made. We're going to come back to that a fair bit because it's the underlying theme of the work. But it's also a careful consideration here, because now as we presented those four situations, we presented them all as like, these are bad things. And yet, they are not always bad things. In fact, they may be the thing you should do in a situation. Like, there should potentially be situations where a change ought to be resisted. Not all change is good. Not all change is something we should welcome with open arms, or that we should try to adjust to, but instead we should resist and fend off. That's going to be true. And so we don't look at this and say, okay, change equals good. Instead, we look at it and we say, I have to examine my situation and know how to respond to that situation in a way that is productive and effective. And that's what we're going to do. As we look through Stolberg's work, we're going to try to basically take on that old proverbial concept of, you know, the reed in the wind. You don't want to be too stiff because you're going to break. You want to be able to bend in the breeze. But also, We don't want to be the reed that is constantly uprooting ourselves at the very suggestion of a stiff breeze and transplanting somewhere else, because that is also not sustainable or, for most of us, very, very effective. So that's where we're going to find. I already know, having read the material, I already know that there's going to be times where Stolberg's going to make a recommendation, and we're going to say, well, we wouldn't quite agree with that exactly. But that's what's going to be so great about this. We'll be able to look at these big principles and try to figure out how does this stuff work for us. One final note that I think just leaves us with a nice practical consideration. As you think about this idea of why change is so hard, remember the cycle of change. Stolberg hammers this home repeatedly in his work. The cycle of change: you start with order, you move to disorder, and you end with reorder. That disorder part in the middle is never fun. Well, with some rare exceptions, I suppose.
Maybe it's more fun for some people than others.
Some people like chaos.
Or do true. Better with chaos.
Runners don't tend to be those people. Well. But yeah. I mean, so the point being that order, disorder, reorder, what do we do during the disorder part that helps become a productive reorder? And that's going to be the key as we look at all of these things. And then we have to say it now because it's going to come up a lot. Then the goal that we aspire toward, as Stolberg lays out, and kind of what we were talking about with the reed example, is this idea of rugged flexibility. It's hardy, it's agile, but it's not just whipping about all over the place either. So we'll get into that. How does that relate to our mindset? How does that relate to our identity? And how does that relate to our actions? And we've got a lot to say as we examine Stolberg's work in the coming weeks. We hope that you anticipate that with great enthusiasm, because it's going to help you achieve your goals.
Sure thing. It absolutely will. And now we're going to get on with some enthusiasm to the world of running. First up, some A to Z runners shout outs. We had quite a few runners at the Resolution Run. Jackie, Mark, Julie, Michelle, Kendra, who is first in age group, Dan O, who is third in age group, Chrissy, Kyle, Aaron, Ben, and Pina, who is third in age group.
And a number of those were personal bests as well. Mm-hmm. It's hard to compare because this is one of those races that is not a specific distance. It's like 4 point something miles. And so as a result, you're not going to run that distance except for at that race. But many did note to us that they were pretty sure that that was a personal best over other times they've run that course. So congrats.
Yes, congrats.
And if you did that and we didn't know, congrats to you as well. Very exciting. Well, okay, so let's start with the new world record. The latest thing to happen in running news was on the final day of 2023. What a way to end the year, right? Beatrice Chebet was basically like, this year hasn't been good enough for me yet. Let me do one more. So at the 5K race in Barcelona, Chebet, racing against previous world record holder at the distance, Edge Gayehu Taye of Ethiopia, among other standouts, ran a new world record road 5K in 14:13.
Snap.
6 seconds under Taye's previous record. Taye herself was second in the race in 14:21, so only a hair slower than her previous record. But what's crazy is all of that time difference between the two of them happened in the last 500 meters, basically.
Wow, what a finish then.
Not surprising with Beatrice Chebet.
Yeah.
It's what she does.
She can close for sure.
On any surface. She's done it in cross country when she was the world champ last year, done it on the track, a number of stellar performances this year, including almost breaking the world record on the track 5K. But, you know, Faith Kipyegon did so right ahead of her.
And then after her.
And then after that. Yeah, we'll yes, talk about that. So good things there. Chebet ended the year with an exceptional performance and can officially say the last world record of the year goes to her, which is always fun. So congrats on that one for sure.
Now we're going to do our top 10 World of Running moments from 2023.
Everyone's doing it, right? They got a top 10 list of the year.
But it's hard to do. Let me say that we've had some discussion between us because there's a lot of amazing things that happened this year.
It is. But I have to say, at least just to simply illustrate the difference in how people report on things like this. So there's a side-by-side that's just quite comical to me. You have Runner's World, they're not a magazine, Runner's World's top 10 or something like that.
Oh, I didn't even see that.
And then you have Kittius Magazine's top 10 or so from the year. And Kittius is like a runner.
Isn't it Sidious Mag?
Yeah.
It's Sidious Mag.
I don't know what it is.
I listen to the podcast and I say Sidious Mag.
Okay, Sidious. So point being, they're like serious runner people and ex-elite runners and stuff like that. And Runner's World is, well, it's Runner's World. And
it's probably like the top thing is that Taylor Swift.
Yeah, so that's exactly what it is. Runner's World's list is like things like, how cool did this person look when they did this thing, and how stylish was this thing, and like new fancy shoes. And you know, Sidious Mag was like people doing amazing things.
Yeah,
like what in the world are you thinking, Runner's World? Anyway, all right. So we're gonna do more like the Sidious Mag stuff, because that's, you know, the stuff that matters in the world of running.
Undeniably,
this is your number one.
Undeniably,
these were in no specific order.
No specific order, but we're gonna start with something that everyone must have on their list, because if not, they're not paying attention to a world changer, record breaker, Faith Kipyegon.
They just don't like her.
Well, that's crazy too. All the world records, it seems. She got the 1500 meter, 1 mile, and 5000 meter record. She still holds the 1500 and the 1 mile. Incredible performances throughout the year, including being completely undefeated in the 1500 meter run this year. She doubled.
Well, she was undefeated in everything except for that road mile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on the, for 1500, she was champ throughout.
Yeah, and 5000.
That's crazy.
Yep.
So she had the double gold at the World Championships in the 1500 and the 5000. Those are just a couple of the things that she did this year.
And correct me if I'm wrong, because we didn't go back and try to double check this, but that she's the only person to do that.
Ever. I did verify that before this episode.
Okay, good.
Yep, she is the very only person to ever run, or at
only
least
one.
A woman,
yeah,
to win both the 1500 meter and the 5000 meter races at the World Championships. Yeah, yep. She was World Athlete of the Year by World Athletics, and I think that was. Very
seems accurate.
Fitting.
Who else would? I mean, there are some other standouts, but yes, yep, good.
So, just a continued look briefly at Kipyegon's dominance. 2016, 1500 meter gold.
We're talking about 2023.
I know,
Andy.
But I'm just giving you this lowdown real quick. 2017 world champion in the 15. 2020 Tokyo Olympics, she got gold in the 15. 2022 world championships, gold in the 15. 2023 world championships. Gold in the 15 and the 5000, and now she has that standout world record in the 1500 meter run and the 1 mile.
Yeah, in case you're taking notes, Faith Kipyegon has not lost a world title run in the 1500 since 2016. The ones that are in between there that she doesn't have the gold are because she didn't run it. So there you go. Okay, now let's move on to the next one. And again, in no particular order, not saying that this is number two, but El Bakkali versus Lamecha Girma was a really interesting dynamic in the men's steeplechase this year. And so Soufiane El Bakkali, Moroccan, has basically like just been on this crazy win streak, but Lamecha Girma broke the world record in the steeplechase
this year.
And then it was like, okay, now they're going to race each other at the world champs. What's going to happen? Well, enter the mind game thing again, right? El Bakkali has an 8-1 head-to-head record against Girma, and that's hard to ignore if you're Girma. Like, in your mind, the question you're always wondering is, how am I going to beat this guy? Because it's so hard to do it. You can break the world record and still find it impossible to beat him.
Because it wasn't in a race that they were going head-to-head.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Truth be told, El Bakkali won the race again in 2023. And it was the one and only time they raced each other this year. But El Bakkali on the Diamond League circuit was just dominant, winning lots of races,
yeah,
extending his win streak.
So Girma, though, yep, he did run the fastest, yep, in history for not only the steeplechase, but also he got the world indoor 3,000 meter record this year in 2023. So Girma's been running fast, the fastest in all of the world's history. So
true.
we shall see what this Olympic year holds.
I mean, the thing is, he's faster in every event. Well, not every event. He's faster in their prime event, but still doesn't ever beat him. He's got to find a way.
Find a way.
We'll see if the Olympic year is the year to do it. All right.
Yard and a Goose, U.S.'s very own and previous podcast guest. He had a phenomenal year. He has now the 1 mile area record and the national record, both outdoor and indoor, and then the 3,000 meter indoor.
So three American records, or three North American records in 1 year. One of those is one of the most difficult records in the United States to break for distance running. That was mm-hmm. the 1 mile outdoor record.
Yeah.
It's a crazy time.
So the indoor record, he ran 7:28.24 in the 3,000, and it belonged to Galen Rupp previously. Took 2 seconds off of his record. And then the 3,000 meter.
That was the 3,000 meter.
Hmm.
You jumped around it from, because he also broke the 1 mile indoor.
Oh, gotcha.
The other one.
Yep.
So the 1 mile indoor record, he ran 3:47, which was just a slice off. It was narrow.
That was the 2 second.
Yep. And then.
Then it was the 10-year-old record held by Galen Rupp that he took a chunk of time off.
In the 3,000.
Is that right?
No. No chunks of time in the indoor races.
Okay.
It was the outdoor mile when Yared Nuguse took one of the most difficult records, as mentioned, and chunked 3 seconds off of it for a 1 mile race. That was insanity. So Yared Nuguse, also the most effective Diamond League circuit series of any American middle distance runner ever, winning Diamond League races. He was top three in three of them. Just crazy stuff. No, top three and four of them. Sorry. And then goes on to nearly beat Jakob Ingebrigtsen in what became the second greatest mile race. You could say the second greatest mile race in all of history. So if the greatest mile race was Hisham El Garouche against Noah Ngeni when the world record was set, those are the top two fastest mile times ever. Noah Ngeni pushed El Garouche to the line and almost beat him. And then Ingebrigtsen and Nuguse did the exact same thing this year. Just a hair slower, becoming the number three and number four fastest mile times ever. Just crazy.
Mm-hmm. As Zach said, I did want to go back to the fact that he did win that Diamond League, and he's the first American man in Diamond League history in the 1500 meter run to win since 2011. So it's been a long time since an American man has won the Diamond League.
Yep.
Very cool.
Indeed. Moving on.
Safwan Hassan's entire year in multiple different races. Quite the range, Safwan Hassan. There were incredible performances. Starting with Chicago Marathon.
That was the last one.
But we're going to start by sharing the Chicago Marathon, where she ran the second fastest all time by a woman in the marathon. It would have been a world record, but
we speak reservedly about the current world fastest marathon.
Okay, well, you go ahead and share.
We'll see. We'll see. But point is, Sifan Hassan ran a course record Chicago Marathon. It's only her second marathon ever. She ran 2:13:44, 43 days. So count it. That's a month and 2 weeks after running a triple at the World Championships in track.
Yeah.
10,000, 5,000, 1,500. And where medaled in two of them.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Where she medaled in two of them. And she would have medaled in three. But remember that dramatic fall? She's
right
running in the 10,000.
Before the finish.
And she was duking it out for first place. And she fell. Yeah. It was right the final stretch of that race. And then she was passed by several people and she ended up 11th, but she was going to get a medal. I don't know what
gold or
which
silver
medal it would have been.
She was going to get silver. I mean, she was getting passed. That's why she fell. Yeah. But yeah. So
silver in the 5,000 and bronze in the 1500 meter run.
And all of that happened just a few months after winning the London Marathon.
Her debut marathon.
So Sifan Hassan in 2023 won two world marathon majors and ran two medals in the world championships on the track in the 1500 and 5000. We said it earlier this year, and we're just going to simply remind you right now, you have never seen anything like Sifan Hassan, and you probably never will again. So pay attention. She is a one-of-a-kind athlete, and it's incredible what she does.
Can I just say, I did read in an article that Faith Kipyegon might run a marathon.
It's not going to be as good as Sifan Hassan.
You don't think so?
Not a chance.
Okay.
Not a chance.
We'll come back to this and replay it if you're
wrong. Someone prove Zach wrong. All right, Gudaf Sigay makes the list, and here's why. In the World Championship, she won the 10,000-meter gold, which that's predictable. She's won medals before.
Yeah.
But she also then broke Faith Kipyegon's 5,000-meter record in what amounted to a mostly solo effort run. Ran almost under 14 minutes for the first time.
Yeah.
By a woman.
14.21.
Crazy.
So incredible. And again, like Zach said, it was solo. It was like a solo effort. And it was at the final Diamond League event. So then she won that event, which is a big deal as well. That was at the Prefontaine Classic in Eugene, Oregon.
So Diamond League champ, world record. That's quite a year.
Quite a year for Sigay.
Got to mention Niels Leros from the Netherlands because, you know, he's like a kid, and yet he's running world-class performances, setting national records as a teenager. Mm-hmm. And
if he was American, he would have the 800-meter, 1,500-meter, and 5,000-meter high school records.
Not including some indoor records. So, yeah, he we're gonna watch his progress because we're very interested to see if he, as many do, you know, if he can sustain progress as he continues to progress in age and maturity in the sport. He might be the next thing. So there you go, Niels Leros from the Netherlands. Keep an eye on him. Well, I mean, we have to mention Jacob Ingebrigtsen on the list because he still does the things that he does, even though he did lose yet another 1,500-meter world championship race, which Andy was mentioning earlier. So what did Ingebrigtsen do this year that was so special? I mean, he broke two world records.
That's special.
He did win another 5,000-meter gold medal, which is not his primary focus event. As a matter of fact, the only time he runs the 5,000 most years is at the World Championships.
It makes you think, like, maybe his specialty event might not be the 1,500. He seems to win at other events, too.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just putting it out there. I don't know.
But he set the 2,000-meter world record and the 2-mile world record on the track. And as we mentioned earlier, ran the number 3 all-time, 1 mile. And that number 3 is hairs off of the world record.
Yeah.
So almost set the 1-mile world record.
So he's good, I guess.
But that's why he's not, though. That's why he's not changing what he's doing.
Yeah, he wants
He wants to break that world record
mile.
He does.
He wants it. That's.
He wants people to stop talking about El Garouche and start talking about Jacob Ingebrigtsen.
Mm.
Not quite there, but he's broken almost every other LG record, so that means something.
Now, the next up is a youngster, Addy Wiley, because we're going into an Olympic year, and we have to pay attention to her. And following her story will make it more interesting for you when it comes trial time. In the 1,500-meter and the 800-meter runs, she ran incredible performances, not just for her age, but just in general. She ran 4:03.22 in the 1,500-meter run at only 19 years old. And she won that race. It was against pros. She's now the second fastest collegiate in history. Only Jenny Simpson has run faster, but she was older. She's 22 years old.
Yeah.
And Jenny Simpson, she's legendary. So to be a hair off of her is being a hair off of a champion. And then the 800-meter run, she ran 157.64, which is the second fastest of all collegians. Can you guess? Think for a second. Can you guess who has the fastest? A thing mo. Of course.
Who also holds the American record.
Who holds the American record of 155. So.
And is the Olympic gold medalist.
Yes.
I mean, you know, things. So that's Addy Wiley. And the mystery remains, what does her future look like? Because she's taking an unconventional path toward all of these things.
She's not running the D1 NCAA route. She's going small school route.
Yep. So we'll see. But we'll keep you posted. We'll be following. That, speaking of young people, we just want to mention Simeon Birnbaum's year. Really, we should just like say the high school senior boys class of last year because of how many crazy things were happening. But among all those crazy things, Simeon Birnbaum was kind of floating to the top almost every single time. So what we're talking about is in the indoor track circuit, he won, I can't remember exactly how many different things, but he won all these indoor titles. And then through the outdoor season, he continued that momentum. He won Arcadia, which is epic and famous, in a crazy fast time. And then later in the season, he finished his outdoor season with 3 races in 6 days. Or 4 days. And what those 3 races were, he ran the second fastest high school 3200 ever, 8:34, which is very fast. 2 days later, ran 3:37 in a 1500. Third in a professional race. And then 2 days after that, won the Nike Outdoor Nationals 1500, ran a 55-second last lap, just outkicked like all the other really fast high schoolers, and he just did it all. Among others, he won Brooks PR, he won Festival of Miles, which I think is a Hoka event. He just like did all of it. Mm-hmm. So now Simeon Birnbaum is in college, and most college freshmen don't really accomplish much at all. But what you tend to notice is sometime after their freshman year in the near future, you really get to see what they're going to amount to. So we're very excited to keep watching Simeon Birnbaum's career, especially as the track season unfolds.
Alicia Munson, 3 American records this year, which are also North American records. So not only are they our country's record, but also the continent. In the 5,000-meter run, she ran a very fast time of 14:19 to break Shelby Houlihan's previous record time of 14:23, so that's more than 4 seconds. And then in the 10,000, she ran at that Sound Running, the 10, which was a great race for a lot of people, by the way. She smashed Molly Huddle's record of 30:13. She dropped over 9 seconds to a 30:03. That's a chunk of time. Fabulous running by Alicia Munson. And then in the indoor 3000 at Millrose, she set the record there too. And it was a personal best by 6 seconds. So she's had a year that was phenomenal, on fire for the record books.
You skipped my honorable mention, didn't you?
Well, I was giving the top 10, and then now you can do your honorable mention. Right. Yeah.
I have an honorable mention because, you know, it was great. Kai Robinson. NCAA Outdoor Championships, ran the 5,000, 10,000 double, won them both as a sophomore, I'm pretty sure, as a young collegian. And that's just uncanny. I think the last one who did that was Ed Cheserek, the famous Ed Cheserek, who won like title after title in the NCAA. But beyond that, only a handful of people have really ever accomplished that. So
I think that's actually who... wasn't that who was spoken about last week? Willie Fink was saying Ed Cheserek, 14 NCAA titles.
And I think he beat him in that mile. I think he has the most NCAA titles by a distance runner. Yeah. But anyway, yes. So that was Kai Robinson last year, and he's continued to be successful. He did not win cross country this year. Many thought that he would, but the upset from Graham Blanks was pretty exciting. As it were, so many exciting things. Mm-hmm. We wanted to just remind you of many of those big moments last year.
Yeah, and I mean, we didn't even mention the 2 world records in the marathon.
No, that's for a longer list of reasons than we have time to go back into right now. But
yeah, so there are a lot of incredible things happened this year. And the reason why we have this section of the podcast is to get you excited about the sport of running. And I think especially this year, being an Olympic year, it's fun to follow these athletes and to know who is doing what in the world of running so that we can have fun as we watch the professional world.
We love the sport. We know that you love the sport or you wouldn't be listening to us.
That's true.
And we like to talk about what's happening in the sport. Sometimes it's running news, like results in races, and sometimes it's interesting information, like from studies and from surveys and from the running population. So we try to bring you the stuff that's going on. And if you ever come across things, as many of you have done in the past, share them, send them our way. Hey, did you guys know about this? We love it. That's always been a lot of fun. But most of all, we want to hear your thoughts, your questions, your comments, your insights. what is on your mind about running, and so that we can talk more about the things that you're thinking. So go to atozrunning.com/questions. You can share any questions that you want with us there, or you can send a direct email to the address questions@atozrunning.com.
Thank you all for joining us for the first episode of the A to Z Running Podcast in 2024, and we'll talk to you next week.